So Jeff and Michael were out of town. He'll be back on Thursday. So he asked me to go in for him on his way. And tonight's class is on denial, which I have to admit I'm a little worried about because it's not really my specialty. But I'll give it a shot, you know?
That ethical way of life, you know, it's tricky. So, it's actually, I hope it'll be interesting because tonight it's interesting for several reasons, one of which is the material tonight includes how to behave towards a llama, you know, how to evaluate a llama and how to tell if you have a good one or not. So, it's interesting that Geshe Michael absented himself tonight, you know, so we can say anything we want, you know, we can really talk. And I would encourage you to really be frank and mix it up. You know, I think it's a good opportunity to really, if you have some things which are bothering you about llamas or how to relate to a llama, or the Tibetan Buddhist notion of putting a lot of faith in a llama, or, you know, sort of giving it all up to a llama in terms of, you know, really giving yourself to him after checking him out, all those sorts of things. Tonight's a prime opportunity to really get into it, and I think probably everyone who has spent any time around the llama has got lots of feelings about this subject. So don't be shy. It's a great opportunity tonight to really get into it and maybe see if we can make some progress and get into some meaty, dirty, interesting conversation. It'll be fun for me. Or maybe not, I don't know. So in any case, I'll continue a little bit with the first half of the Vinaya class. The first half of the Vinaya class was the Pratimoksha vows, the eight different classes of individual freedom vows, which I believe they've all been covered. Am I correct? Yeah? Okay. So in the original Vinaya class, Geshe Michael spent the first half of the class talking about the Pratimoksha vows, and then the second half of the Vinaya class, a couple of weeks, he actually did a Lam Rim study. So I'm not going to go into the Lam Rim so much because probably you've all heard it a lot. And the Lam Rim review was already done in an earlier course. So I'm going to recap a little bit on the homework questions and the elements of the Vinaya, and then we'll get into this llama thing, you know, and see how that goes. Main points in terms of studying Vinaya, you know, why study Vinaya? In the Hinayana system, the main reason for studying Vinaya is to attain nirvana. By keeping your vows, you can eliminate your mental afflictions and attain nirvana. And the Vinaya is oriented, studying Vinaya and keeping the vows detailed in the eight sets of Pratimoksha vows, that primarily addresses misdeeds of body and speech and not so much of mind. It's bodhisattva vows and highest vows, secret vows, tantric vows, which address misdeeds of mind more so than the Vinaya. They're called individual freedom vows because if you keep them, they lead you to freedom, to nirvana. That's the idea. Nirvana, for those of you who don't know, is a complete cessation, a complete removal of all of your bad thoughts, all of your mental afflictions, all of your anything which would ever disturb your mind would be ended. Just to recap what the eight classes of Pratimoksha vows are, individual freedom vows are, you have one-day vows, you have lifetime layman's vows, you have lifetime lay woman's vows, you have novice monk's vows, you have novice nun's vows, you have intermediate nun's vows, you have full nun's vows, and you have full monk's vows. So, once you've got the vows, once you've taken the vows, the study of Vinaya covers how you get the vows, how you keep the vows, how you break the vows, and what you do to restore the vows. And we can't really go into any of those things because you require ordination to get into the details. So the idea of this course was to give an overview, just to understand it from a broader perspective without breaking any of the vows of the monks by talking about the details. So I'm going to, although I'm not a Tibetophile myself and I don't speak Tibetan, I'm going to be diligent and provide all of the Tibetan materials for those of you who do like Tibetan. So when you have, once you do have the individual freedom vows, how do you lose them? What can cause any of the vows to be broken or lost? The first thing is called lapapul. We say lapapul. Come on, lapapul. All right. Lapa is precepts, pul is to offer. It means that you formally give them back. You actually undergo a ceremony. You recite words from a scripture, or you officially and formally give your vows back. I'm going to zip through this stuff because it's not really relevant to my life, because I'm not a monk. But Dr. Sykes, you might be interested. The second is shifu. Please say shifu. She is dying, and pu is transmigrating, moving on, i.e. you died, you lost them. It's pretty straightforward. Where you move on to, you know, another matter. Please say senyijung. Senyijung. Sen is sex organ, nyi is two, and jung is if they appear. What does that mean? Any guesses? No? Okay. That's if you were born with two sex organs. It has to do with your subtle body, with your energetic body. If you were born without a male or female system, you can't get ordained in the first place. So what does this mean? Oh, I'm sorry. That means if it grows afterwards. Okay. There you go. As I said, not too relevant to my life, I hope. Okay. So, the next way you get rid of your individual freedom vows. What happened there? Yeah. Yeah, nothing yet. I hope, yeah. Please say Len Sum Gyur. Len Sum Gyur. So Len is times, Sum is three, and Gyur is change. This means if you really like surgery and you change your sex three times. Okay. Or if you have mystical abilities to change your gender otherwise. Which I presume was the case back in the 1,000 years ago. Bingo, you got it. You're there, you know. You can switch genders, feel like you would have rather been the original gender and go back and you're still okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. No, not at all. This is from the scripture from, you know, 1500 years ago, where they listed the things which would cause monks and nuns to lose their ordination. And at the time, as a result of advanced meditative abilities and other things, it was possible to change gender and things like that, where a man could change himself into a woman, etc. And so these are just quickly recapping what the rules of the sutra are for monks and nuns, which outline if you do these things, you lose your ordination, you'll break your vows. That's all.
Can you talk about castration?
It's not. It's to my knowledge, it's not specifically. Well, you don't have to explain it. You just have to list it. This is on the homework. You just have to itemize five things. That's all. No explanation necessary, thankfully. That's why I'm going to zip through them, because I don't have... having both sexual organs appear on your body. That's how it's described.
Like male
and female, yeah. Yeah. This is really going to be a salient question, Dr. Sykes.
No.
Okay. We'll pass. okay. Please say, Getsache. Getsache. You lose your core of virtue. Ge is virtue. Sa is root of. And che is cut. Your core. You cut your root of virtue. Yeah, there you go. Sure. I often wondered if anybody really copies this Tibetan down. I guess they do. You do. I don't mean to discourage you from studying Tibetan, by the way. I should keep my... I really want to get to the Lama stuff, so I'm just going to move through this. I was afraid somebody was going to ask me that. When you lose your core of virtue, it means you hold wrong views, Punsa? That basically you do something really wrong, which cuts your basic connection, like believing that karma doesn't exist, believing that having wrong views about emptiness, that type of thing. That's how you cut your core of virtue. Yeah, Dr. Sykes. All right, he's going to pass. Are you guys done with this transparency? Yeah. Dr. Sykes is going to be my nemesis. You know, he's making faces at me. He's trying to see if he can unnerve me up here. So we'll see how we do. So please say Nekap, Drebu, Lami. Nekap, Drebu, Lami. This is one of the results of keeping your vows. If you keep your vows nicely, then you have two results, and this is the first one. Nekup means in the short term. Drebu means the result. Hla is deva, or angel. And mi is human. If you keep your vows, you have a higher birth. You have a birth as a human, or a deva, an angelic type being, a pleasure being, being of a higher realm. And the second result of keeping your vows. Please say Janchub Sum. Janchub Sum. Sum is three, and Janchub is enlightenment. Means that you attain one of the three enlightenments. Any ideas what the three enlightenments are? Yeah, good. It's attaining either of... It's called the total enlightenment, which is Buddhahood, or it is attaining the enlightenment of a listener, or the enlightenment of a self-made Buddha. In the Hinayana path, they consider nirvana to be enlightenment. In the Mahayana path, there's a different enlightenment. So between Hinayana and Mahayana, enlightenment is not the same thing. And so... What is a listener? What is the nirvana of a listener? What is the enlightenment of a listener? It means someone who has listened to the teachings and become enlightened as a result. And the self-made Buddha is someone who has not had a teacher teach them, and yet they still become enlightened. So now, how is that possible? How is it possible to become enlightened if no one teaches you? Isn't that sort of contrary to what's taught and to what's said? Yes, and Lindsay points out correctly, you have no teacher in that lifetime. You cannot become enlightened unless someone leads you along the way, leads you along the path. And so a self-made Buddha is someone who in their current life, their present life, has not had a teacher in person. But in their previous lifetimes, they've had extensive teachings. And so they're very ripe. They've accumulated tremendous amounts of knowledge and progress in their spiritual path. And in that lifetime, they become enlightened on the nirvana track, meaning they attain nirvana. What is nirvana? Nirvana means that you have a complete cessation of all mental afflictions. Your mind is in a space which is very happy and blissful, and nothing bothers it or disturbs it. That's nirvana. The difference with the enlightenment of Mahayana path is that you have the same type of mental happiness or bliss, but you have the bodhisattva activity. You have the aspiration to help all beings, and so you have countless emanation bodies and form bodies and activities to set out and to undertake assisting all existing beings to eliminate their suffering. So that's the difference between the nirvana enlightenment and the total enlightenment. Yeah, Jojo. So the question was, does a listener become enlightened only by listening and not by meditating? Good question. I don't know. Anybody know? Dito? You got it? You don't know? Oh, you had a question. Do you know, Ellie?
You called listeners because they can listen to Mahayana, but they can't practice it.
But in terms of becoming enlightened, though?
No, they practice. They just practice.
Meditate? Meditate? Practice?
It's just the reason they're called listeners is that, but it doesn't refer to their practice.
So Ellie was saying, yeah, she said they do practice, but do they have to practice? Well, I don't know. I don't think there's a definitive conclusion that they have to practice. Logically speaking, according to the laws of karma, it seems to me they would have to meditate and they would have to practice. Ellie pointed out that if you're a listener, you listen to Mahayana, but you don't practice it. Is another element of that. Yeah, all right. I'm sorry?
The transition between levels to heaven.
Yeah, Ari was saying that, you know, according to the other teachings, if you're going to move from path to path or level to level and have any realizations or attainments, that it can only happen in deep meditation. So if you're going to attain nirvana, that would have to happen during meditation. So, I mean, we can logically think it out. I couldn't say from a direct scriptural reference that, yeah, Jason Kappa said, da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, that's a definitive answer. So Nanette was saying, well, she thought that if you had a lot of virtue, you would always have teachers around. And so how karmically would you have enough virtue to attain nirvana, but not have enough virtue to have a teacher present to lead you there? Like that? Yeah. To see them, yeah. Yeah. You know, you collect karma in relationship to different beings and different objects. And so if you're going to have a teacher around, you have to collect karma in relationship to a teacher. You know, serving a teacher properly is the karmic cause for having a teacher. It's possible in, you know, there are so many trillions and trillions and trillions of karma in your mind stream. And the permutations of their combination are vast, you know. And do you have enough karmic seeds of a particular type so that they will configure and arise for a particular kind of perception? Well, that will determine your perception, you know. If you have the mix of karma to not see a teacher, then that's what you'll see. That's the only way it could be. So you could at the same time have enough virtue to see yourself as being quite blissed out and happy, but not have the virtue to see someone, or not have the karmic imprints to project a being there who is leading you along the way, you know. And we're going to talk more about that later, actually. You know, what is the karma? What happens karmically when you're around a teacher? You know, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? You know, it's like that. So those are the two results of keeping your vows. Now, on your homework, there's a lot of information about the karmic consequences of keeping your vows and not keeping your vows. And I don't really want to get into it too much. I'm going to let you guys go over that during the discussion groups. But basically, there are three results of karma, three types of result that karma brings to you. And on your homework, it asks you, what are the correlations between each of the 10 non-virtues and each of the three karmic consequences? You know, if you kill, what are the three levels of karmic consequence of killing? Okay? The three different types or levels of karmic consequence are, one, that it creates your environment. Whatever you do creates your environment. Okay, there's an environmental result to a karma. The second is there's a personal result. You experience something yourself. Okay? And the third is that you have a predisposition or a habit which you create in yourself to behave a certain way in the future. Okay? So those are the three types of karmic consequence. And so on your homework, and you can talk about it in your discussion groups if you like, on your homework, it's, you know, they want to know what the three different consequences are of each of the 10 non-virtues, you know, if you kill, if you steal, if you sexual misconduct, if you lie, etc. Okay? Sexual misconduct, for example, just to mention it briefly, the environmental result of sexual misconduct, does anybody know? You live in a stinky place. you have a lot of pollution. You have a lot of unpleasant smells, a lot of unpleasant visual sights, like that. What is the personal result if you engage in sexual misconduct? What happens to you? I heard a whispering, but missed it. Yeah, you can't have a relationship. You can't keep a relationship. If you steal love, essentially, you know, if you take someone from another person, then you will not be able to keep love yourself. You will not be able to keep a relationship yourself. You know, you will have a lot of competition for your mate. Your mate will be easily distracted, wandering. You know, you'll lose your mate. They'll be interested in other people, like that. So, and what is the other consequence, the habit that you generate if you do that? Anybody know?
Jealousy.
You create jealousy? Yeah, that's one idea. Anybody else have any ideas? Yeah. You create people around you who are undependable, people who are inconsistent, and you have the habit yourself of sort of wandering, you know. There's a lot of inconsistency. Okay? So that's the idea. And in your discussion groups, if you want to, you can go through the ten. Yeah, Elizabeth. So Elizabeth was saying there are three consequences that were talked about before as a result of karma. One is if you do a negative karma strongly, you'll go really intensely. You end up in a really suffering realm, like a hell realm. If you do a karma with a medium degree of intensity, you know, you end up in a moderately bad realm. And if you do a negative deed with a very light intensity, you know, maybe not even aware that you're doing it, that, you know, that you'll have perhaps an animal birth or a suffering human birth. So her question was, how does that fit in? You know, how does that fit in with these three things? It's a different classification. It's a different grouping, basically. They basically just say negative karmas have three results in that way, and negative karmas have three results in this way. And what you're talking about is just where you're going to, you know, in the future, in future births. And what they're talking about here is what happens to you in your future birth, what the result is in your future birth, what it's like in your future birth, like that. Okay? So there's several pages of this. It's good luck in the discussion groups and on your homework. There are four special qualities to the teachings on enlightenment, the Lamrim teachings, and I just want to touch on those basically, briefly, if I can find the transparency. Yep. And I'm just going to put this up here again briefly for the benefit of the Tibetan Track people. Please say Tempa Gelme. Tempa Gelme. So Tempa is teachings. Gel is inconsistencies. And Me is none. So there are four special qualities to the teachings of the Buddha. Teachings on Lamrim. And this is the first of them. And basically what it means is that you realize that all of the teachings of the Buddha are free of any inconsistencies. Now what does that mean? You know, you could say, well, wait a minute, what are you talking about? You know, and one sutra the Buddha says it's this way, and the next sutra the Buddha says that's not right, it's the opposite way. Of course there are inconsistencies, of course there are mistaken things and inaccurate things. You know, the sutras disagree with each other. So what this means is that insofar as the different sutras and the different teachings were given for specific people and their capacities to lead them and to bring them up to the next level from where they are, there are no inconsistencies. All of the teachings of the Buddha were designed to bring people along the path from where they are to the next level beyond where they are. So while it may appear that there are inconsistencies in the teaching, if you look at it at face value, if you interpret it, and if you look at the motivation and the purpose behind the teachings, every single teaching is designed to bring people along towards enlightenment from whatever level they're on. And in that respect, even though various sutras disagree with each other, each and every teaching of the Buddha has the same specific purpose and is accurate and valid and effective in bringing various classes of beings and peoples and minds along in their level of understanding. So it's like that. So please say Sungrab, Dampar, Char. Sungrab, Dampar, Char. You know, Punsok is sitting up here. He's probably like thinking, ah, he's butchering this Tibetan. But doing my best, Punso. So Sumarab is the high speech of the Buddhas. Dampar is personal advice. And Char is strikes you. It strikes you. It seems to you, it strikes you. Dampar is personal advice. And it means that all of the teachings, all of the speech of the Buddhas strikes you as personal advice. It doesn't strike you as academic book knowledge. It doesn't strike you as something written for someone else. It doesn't strike you as some intellectual thing to maybe wrap your mind around one day. It strikes you as something which you can use in your life right now, and it's immediately and personally salient to you. You know, it means like, oh, I get it. In my life, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. This is what they're said to be doing in my life right now. That's the idea with that. Please say Giel, Gong, Delak, Nye. Giel, Gong, Delak, Nye. Giel is the victorious Buddhas. Gong is the true intent. Delak is easy happiness. And Nye is to find. The Gya is victorious Buddhas. Victorious Buddhas. Mm-hmm. And what this means is that each and every word and each and every teaching that you hear, you feel and you realize is directed at you personally, so that you can reach enlightenment. You feel that everything that you hear, everything that you study, is done for the specific purpose of your reaching enlightenment. And nothing that you study and nothing that you read strikes you as being for any other purpose. Okay? Like that. If you pick up a book and you read it, and it's a valid sutra, you know, you say, wow, you know, this, they're teaching me how to get enlightened. This is not something that is irrelevant to my life. Every single sutra that was ever taught, you would feel that way. Please say Nyechu, Chenpoi, Yang, Sele, Sung. Nyechu, Chenpoi, Yang, Sele, Sung. Oops, sorry. You do. Punsuk. I need Punsuk. He's my Tibetan sidekick. You know, whenever there's Tibetan stuff, I always ask him to come along. You know. Now let's try it again. Nyechu, Chenpoi, Yang, Sele, Sung. That's perfect for me. Although Punsuk, you know, I know it's butchered. Move it up. Yeah. So Nyechu Chenpoi is a great mistake. What is Yangsa, Punsuk? What is Yangsa? I don't know either. He doesn't know, and I don't know. Anybody know what Yangsa means? Any Tibetan experts in the audience? No? All right. It's a mystery one, guys. We can do the last two. Le Sung. Le is from, and Sung is protected. I was going to try to bleep over it, but I was sure somebody would ask, so I just fess up. Cliff? That's a good one. So Punsuk said Yangsa, he thinks, means cliff. That works, actually. And what it means is you're protected from the cliff or the great mistake. And what is that? It means that you're protected from rejecting any of the Buddha's teachings as being wrong or invalid or useless or inappropriate, because of the prior point that you realize that they all contribute to reaching enlightenment. Okay? So those are the four main points. The four qualities of the teachings. Repeat which, what it means. The last one means that you are protected from rejecting any teaching as being irrelevant or useless or not being valid or useful, because you realize that every single teaching is directed at you to lead you to enlightenment. Okay? You guys finish with this one? Okay, now we get into the good stuff. This is the stuff that I'd like to talk about, is your relationship with your lama. And that is, what is an appropriate relationship with a lama? And, are you done? Not done. Okay. What is an appropriate relationship with a lama? How do you tell if you have a good lama? How do you tell if your lama's wacky? How do you tell if your lama's being way out of line? And, you know, your lama bugs the crap out of you, and what do you do about it, you know? And any other lama-related irritations and questions and issues that happen to come up. So, there are 10 qualities. I'm going to go through the... I'll talk a little bit first. Basically, the first thing that you should realize... Let me say it differently. It's important to understand that everything you experience and everything that you perceive is a function of your mind and your projections. It's a very important point, and it's a big pitfall that many people fall into, to think that lamas are self-existent, holy people. That if everyone says so, and if they got their picture on lots of books, and if they're the Dalai Lama, or Ken Rinpoche, or Geshe Michael, or any other lama, that they, from their own side, are holy. They're not. Okay? There's a critical point that you all understand. there are beings who perceive His holiness as quite an evil guy. Okay, He cannot be self-existently holy if some beings perceive Him as evil and other beings perceive Him as holy. Okay, nor can anyone else. It violates the laws of karma, it violates the laws of emptiness, and if you think that teachers, lamas, are self-existently holy, then you don't understand karma and emptiness, and and you're going to get in trouble most likely, particularly if you spend any time around a lama. So what do you do? Well, I mean, what is this whole lama thing about? You know, why do you see a lama as holy? Any ideas? Why do you see a lama as holy? Because of your karma. Because of your projections. You are projecting the idea, the concept, that this is a good guy, that this is a holy guy, that this is a special guy. Okay? Will you always have that projection? No. Okay? It's entirely feasible that you will see someone as extremely holy for a period of time, and you will see them as a royal pain in the butt for a period of time, and you will see them as extremely abusive for a period of time. And all those things can be valid perceptions and will be valid perceptions from you, from your side, for you. Okay? Very important to realize, very important to understand. There are no self-existent holy beings. How do you get beings to appear holy to you? It goes back to Nanette's question. Why wouldn't you have a holy teacher around? Why wouldn't a being appear holy to you? If I had the karma, if my mind functioned properly, I would be seeing each and every one of you as a holy lama right now. Okay? The simple fact that I am not seeing Ellie or Anne or Dr. Sykes as a holy being right now means that I have not done enough virtue, and my projections and my perceptions are corrupted, and I have negative karmas ripening, and I'm seeing people as limited and am experiencing them as limited. Okay? It's a very profound point, it's a very profound subject, and it's a very important subject. So how do you get a lama? How do you get a holy lama? How do you have a perception of a holy lama? You must collect the karma to experience the resultant outcome of perceiving someone as a holy lama, i.e., you must treat a being or more than one beings in the proper way karmically to plant karmic seeds which will ripen into the result of a perception of a holy lama. Okay? That's why you wouldn't have a lama in your life, because you haven't done enough virtue, specifically the karmic virtues needed in relationship to a lama, to create a lama, to have a perception of a lama, to be around a lama. If you're around a lama, you are consuming and burning up vast amounts of virtuous karma. Just being around them, just seeing them, just hearing them, consumes and uses and finishes vast amounts of virtuous karma. Okay? And this is one of the reasons why in the teachings it says you must behave properly in relationship to your lama. You must treat your lama properly because you collect the karmas in relationship to your lama. Hold on, let me say it differently. You plant the karmic seeds to have a lama from the way you behave towards your lama. So if you don't behave properly towards a being that you consider to be holy, then you are not going to plant the karmic seeds to experience someone in the future as a holy being, as a teacher, as a spiritual teacher. Okay? So that's the idea. It's a little bit tricky, perhaps. It's a little bit slippery. Hopefully it's clear. It's a very important point. So, yeah, Mike.
Burning up positive.
Using.
Why not you're getting the chance to burn up negative when you're around a lama? Mm-hmm.
So Michael said if you're using vast amounts of virtuous karma by being around a lama, why aren't you consuming vast amounts of negative karma? Yeah. So Michael was saying, when you're around the Lama, you have the opportunity to use up or purify. Is it purifying, you mean, or to purify a lot of negative karma? There's an important distinction that I would make. When you're around a Lama, it's not that you are destroying virtuous karma, or it's not that you are burning up virtuous karma. The ripening of virtuous karmic seeds is the perception of the Lama. The fact that you are perceiving a Lama is the manifestation of karma's flowering in your mind and ripening in your mind, second by second, moment by moment. Okay? If you perceive a Lama in front of you, that is your virtuous karma ripening and being used up. That's what perceiving a Lama is. So if you want to purify negative karma in relationship to a Lama, you can do that. Or you can accumulate a lot of negative karma in relationship to a Lama. It just depends on your thoughts and your behavior. You know, it goes back to an understanding of how things exist and what the nature of perception is and how karma works. You know, you can think of it as a projector. Your mind is the collection of your karmic imprints, not your brain, but your mind stream. Your mind stream is the collection of your karmic imprints. Okay? Your mind is, your perception of your mind is the flowering of the karmas in your mind. Your perception of me and everyone around you is the flowering of your karma. It takes trillions and trillions and trillions of discrete karmas flowering at any given moment to construct a reality. And there are vast amounts of karma ripening every millisecond to provide you with enough data to have the perception that you have. You can think of it as a projector, you know. It's a fairly good analogy to think that, you know, your mind is doing the projecting and it's got to have a lot of stuff that it's projecting out there to create a whole reality, you know, to create all of this, you know, of this, all of the data of these six senses, you know. To have perception of all that takes a vast amount of karma, which is ripening and which is going off. So it's a little slippery, it's a little subtle. Yeah. Question is, is there a way to shut off your projections and to just witness? If you are witnessing, you are projecting. According to Buddhism, the very act of being aware and sentient, the very act of being conscious, means that you are having perception. If you are having perception of any kind, it's a projection. So it's, there's no way to escape that. It's not a question of the perceiver and the perceiving. It's a question of if you're conscious, you're aware, and you're projecting. There's no, without one, there is not the other possible. Like that. Yeah. Okay.
When you say, I heard it like that, You're saying if you're around the Lama, you're burning up more.
Not burning up. You keep saying burning up. You're not burning up. You are using up.
Okay, using up. Okay. So you're using up more karma than you would.
I didn't say you're using up more karma. I said you're using up virtuous karma. I said you use a vast amount of virtuous karma to perceive the Lama. If you perceive a Lama, it means you have in your mind flowering at that moment a vast amount of virtuous karma.
It just means that it's difficult to see, or you know, I don't understand.
Think of it this way: if I see you as Michael, it means I have a mix of karmas flowering in my mind at this moment to perceive you as Michael. Okay. Now, if I have more negative karmas flowering in my mind at this moment, I will perceive you as a real jerk, okay? If I have more virtuous karmas, yeah, well, it would be valid at the moment, it's true. But not self-existently. So, So if I have, at that moment, more virtuous karmas flowering in my mind, I would be perceiving you as a really great guy. And the more, if my mind were filled with a tremendous amount of virtuous karmas flowering at that moment, I would be perceiving you as maybe an angel, or maybe a teacher, or maybe a holy being. So it's like that. So if I'm perceiving a lama, it means in my mind at that moment, I have a tremendous amount of virtuous karmas which are flowering and going off and creating that perception. What? Turn it off? No. You're done. So that's my point. Okay, my point is, be aware that if you are perceiving a lama, and if you are spending time around a lama, the very act of having that perception is consuming, is the expression of virtuous karma ripening. And it's getting used up at a very fast rate. Yeah, Dave. So Deva says, if you have the virtue in your mind to perceive someone, say Geshe Michael, as a holy teacher, then surely you would also be accumulating virtue at the same time. No. Lots of people see Geshe Michael as a teacher or as a holy being one day, and then the next afternoon they're really pissed off at him. And they accumulate a tremendous amount of negative karma. So it's like that. Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
God forbid, huh? So Marie's question is, how would you create the cause to see me as a lama? To which I said, holy smokes. Or someone like Geshe Michael as a lama. It could be anyone, you know. And this is actually the key to the secret teachings of Buddha, to Tantra. Whomever you select to enter into that type of relationship with is it, you know. I mean, essentially, we all have to choose at some point to behave virtuously towards one particular individual, three people, or everybody. You know, the point of bodhicitta is to choose to try to be virtuous towards everyone, to try to behave well towards everyone. Now, frankly, in our lives, our past karma is causing us to see some people as better than others. You know, my valid perception right now is, some of you guys are a lot nicer than others, you know? And some of you know a lot more, and some of you are a lot more experienced, and some of you are a lot more holy than others. And it's a valid perception, and it's the result of past virtue and past karma's ripening. So, normal, valid, conventional perception makes it easier for us to relate to some people as holy. And it gives you a platform or a head start to relate properly towards them. Okay? If I see Ellie as a teacher, as a holy person who knows a lot about meditation, who has a lot of experience, who's very pure, who's very virtuous, it's a lot easier for me to think of her as someone I should treat nicely and kindly and respectfully, okay? As opposed to someone else. Say myself. As opposed to someone else who I don't respect very much and who I don't think very highly of. It's much harder for me to treat someone I don't respect very much and don't think very highly of in a pure way. Okay? It's very difficult for me to make offerings to them, to be very kind to them, to be very respectful to them, to help them in any way I possibly can, to go out of the way to do what they say, you know, to do anything I can to further their noble causes. It's very hard for me to do that with somebody who I don't like, or somebody I think is just average, okay? So it's like that. The idea is that the laws of karma apply to this as everything else. You must plant the appropriate karmic seeds to have the perception in the future of a lama. And you can do that in relationship to various beings, you know? It's easiest to do it with someone you already see as a lama, okay? That's the idea. So you got to jump, you got to head start. Your conventional perception is giving you a boost to make it easier for you to relate to someone and to serve them and to do virtue in relationship to them. So it's like that. Now, in Tantra, the point is, well, maybe you shouldn't only think about one person that way, you know? And the same is true of the Mahayana, you know? You shouldn't just try to help one person. You should try to relate in this way to everyone so that you can accumulate vast amounts of merit towards everyone, Think about it. If you treated every single person as a holy being, as your lama, what are you creating the cause for? What karmic seeds are you planting? You are creating the karmic cause to perceive a large number of holy beings in your future. Okay? That's the point. That's the long and the short of it. Okay? It's like that. Yeah. Okay. Moving right along. So, let's go through the 10 qualities of the lama, of what a lama is supposed to be like. So, now I'll say another thing too, not to overload you or talk too much, but so what does it mean if, you know, you don't like your lama today? You know, what does it mean if your lama is pushing your buttons? What does it mean if this guy is just like, seems to be really jerking you around, you know? Or lady, what do you do? How do you behave in relationship to that? How do you treat that? What if one day you see the guy as a massively accomplished meditator, and the next day you see him as somebody who's really taking advantage, who's really out of it, or who's really a big loser? You know? Yeah, Marie. One way to look at it is to look at it from his side, which is to say, from his side, well, maybe he's an enlightened being, maybe he's not. We don't know. If he is an enlightened being, he's trying to bring you up. He's intentionally pushing your buttons and trying to test you and sort of cause you to flex your muscles of virtue to see if you can exercise patience and restraint and virtuous behavior in the face of difficult circumstances and conditions. So that's one way to think about it, of how he is from his side. What about how it is from your side? You know, how would you think about it as to how it is from your side? Right. Yeah. Yeah. So Anne says, you know, well, if you see your lama as a jerk, you know, it's because you don't have enough virtue. It's because at that moment you've got karmic seeds ripening to see him as a jerk. And it's valid. You see him as a jerk. The point is, how do you change that in the future? These are the laws of karma. These are the standard laws of karma. You know, if someone's yelling at you, how do you change it in the future? Do you yell back? No. You know, you treat them nicely. You know, it changes. It changes your environment. It changes your circumstances. It changes things. If you see your lama as a loser or incompetent or lacking and having serious character flaws in some way, you have a choice. You say, okay, I will go find another lama, or whatever you're going to say. Or you say, all right, I'm going to behave differently in relationship to him specifically and other people in general to create the karmic causes to see someone pure or more pure in the future. Like that. Yeah. Yeah.
So there's two aspects. One, person A, the correct perception.
Valid perception.
There is such a thing called correct.
Well, it's definition of terms. When you say correct, it doesn't have a meaning in Buddhism. If there's a valid perception, is that what you mean? That would be self-existent. You mean, when you say correct, do you mean self-existent from his own side? No, there's nothing that exists in that way. That would mean that there's a self-existent thing. That would mean that if a person from their side was always a jerk or always unpleasant, that everyone that ever came in contact with them at that moment in time would perceive them that way. And it doesn't work that way. Everyone's perception is unique to them. Why don't you just pick anybody and go with it? Well, on some level...
Mm-hmm.
No, that's not correct, actually. His point was, that person has a nature, and it's a question of me being able to perceive it correctly. And that's actually the opposite of the teachings on emptiness. According to the teachings on emptiness, that person has no nature of their own, and we perceive them according to our perception. So, well, again, you have to study emptiness. Saying, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Valid teachings, accurate teachings.
Accurate.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No. No. The fact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If the Buddha's teachings were self-existently correct, then everyone that ever heard them would think they were correct. And there are plenty of people who don't think they're correct. Yeah, everyone's perception determines what they can perceive. Yeah, it's like that. So,
there is, it is correct, right? Mm-hmm. And then, can I see it as correct?
It's important that you're able to perceive it properly. Yeah. So I'm going to leave it at that. So, if you want to talk afterwards, we can talk some more afterwards. But we got to move on. So, going back to the Lama, going back to your relationship to your Lama, to how you see your Lama, how you behave towards your Lama. I mean, I can tell you from personal experience, you know, I've spent a lot of time around a particular Lama and some other Lamas, and it's a pain in the butt often, you know? I mean, it's a royal pain in the butt. You know, sometimes I see a Lama as being really way out there, you know? As behaving in a way which is incredibly distasteful to me, or to a way in a way which I would never want to behave in, or doing things which I don't like, or doing things which I think are very holy, you know, or which I aspire to, and it's very easy for me to say, man, this guy is really screwed up, you know, there's some real problems here, there's some real inadequacies here, but if I step back and think about it from a karmic perspective. It's not about him, it's about me, you know? It's about my mind and my projections. If I don't want to see a Lama in some dysfunctional behavior, then I have to clean up my mind, you know? And that's the long and the short of it. And it's very dangerous to think of a Lama as being self-existent and then thinking that they're doing something right or that they're doing something wrong, you know? To have attachment to a Lama is ignorance. You know, to want to be around a Lama, to attach yourself to a Lama in an ignorant way is very bad. You know, if you understand the nature of perception, if you understand the nature of karma, if you want to serve that Lama, if you want to help that Lama, great. According to the teachings on emptiness, according to the teachings on karma, all well and good. But having ignorant attachment, those are the basic three poisons which are at the center of the wheel of life, you know? And if you just exhibit them in relationship to a Lama, it's still the three poisons, you know? It's still ignorance. You know, you're just taking your basic ignorance and doing the same old thing over again, you know, in relationship to a holy, what you could perceive as, and maybe do perceive as, a holy object, okay? So, whenever you're around a holy being or a Lama, it's critically important that you keep in mind the laws of karma and emptiness, and you are constantly aware of the fact that whatever you are perceiving is a projection of you, of your karma ripening, your mental constructs, and your projections. Okay? And if you don't like what you see, then clean up your own act. Now, having said that, what about valid perceptions? What about people who do perceive a Lama as being abusive and get hurt? What about all the people who have been hurt by various Lamas of various lineages, traditions, you know, etc., etc., etc.? You know, there is the very real issue of valid perceptions. You know, if you're a woman and a Lama is hitting on you, and you see a Lama hitting on you, it's a valid perception. It's happening. You know? And what do you do about it? You know, how do you relate to that? You know, how do you think about that? Do you think, God, I'm so disappointed in this guy. I can't believe this guy's doing this to me. You know, I had such faith in this guy. And now look at him. You know? He's a schmuck like everybody else. Or he's totally disappointed in me. Or whatever it is you're going to think, you know? It's extremely important to realize that it's happening based upon your past karma. And it's equally important to realize that your perceptions are valid and you must also deal with them on a conventional level. Okay? I know plenty of women who sort of wanted to do the dance with a Lama to sort of try to interact with him, challenge him, you know, see how close they could get. And I know a woman who ended up, she was, you know, a lovely, beautiful woman. You know, she ended up getting pregnant from a very, you know, a very high lama. You know, it's a valid perception from me. It's a valid perception from her. I don't know what the lama's perception is. He may see her as a consort, you know, or a tantric angel or a deity or something like that, you know. And she may see him as the same. I have no idea. But from your side and from my side, we have to be aware of what our valid perceptions are, you know. And if you see a lama which is who is misbehaving a lama which is doing something which you consider to be conventionally inappropriate, you must address it on a conventional level, and you must understand it on a karmic level, which is to say, man, it's really, really disappointing that this lama is hitting on me, and I created this through my past karma, and it's not acceptable that it's happening, and I have to create the causes for it to be different in the future. Okay? Very important. Similarly, you know, if a lama is... Well, I'll leave it at that. Yeah, Brooks. And here. Brooks' point is if I have really excellent karma, is it possible for me to have the perception that a lama would never do anything bad towards me or wrong towards me, like that, right? Yeah, I mean, that's what a Buddha is. A Buddha is a being who cannot perceive anyone doing anything negative to them. That's what it means, you know? I mean, again, I'll refer to the tanka of a popular tanka which is painted of Shakyamuni Buddha sitting in meditation in full lotus posture under the tree as he attains enlightenment. And in the tanka, you know, he's surrounded by all the demons of all the realms, you know, and enemies, and they're throwing swords at him in the tanka and weapons of all sorts and shooting arrows, and the weapons turn into flowers, and there's just a cloud of flowers around him which fall to the ground. That's the meaning of that tanka. The meaning of that tanka is those beings see themselves as trying to do harm. The other being can't see himself being harmed. The two are not inconsistent, you know. And it's the same way with the lama's behavior. You do not know if the lama is trying to bring you up or is trying to hurt you. You must try to decide that. You must evaluate it. You must assess it. You must not judge them. You must look at it and say, I'm experiencing this according to my own perceptions. They are experiencing it according to their own perceptions. I do not know what their perceptions are. I do not know if they're trying to help me or harm me. But from my side, I have to look at it to ascertain whether or not I think this person is trying to help me or harm me. And I have to then act based upon my decision. If I perceive the lama is trying to push my buttons to bring me up, great. I'll stay in relationship with that lama. If I perceive that a lama is trying to hurt me, I'm not staying in relationship with that lama, conventionally speaking. And I will go off, and I will create the causes, karmically, to have a lama who will treat me sweetly and purely and nicely. Okay? You know, there's a saying that if you're ready, the teacher appears. Well, I mean, it's a bit of a you know, trivial statement, but it's karmically, it's true. If you have created the karma causes, you must have a teacher. You can't escape it. You can't avoid it. Okay? Similarly, if you created the karmic causes, you'll get whatever teacher you created, you know? And it's not static, it's constantly in flux. Yeah, Dr. Sykes.
What about a lama that's clearly in violation of all the vows that you hold dear?
So Dr. Sykes' question is, what about a lama who is clearly in violation of all the vows you hold dear? I would say that sounds like a conclusion. I would say the first thing that you have to do is go through a process of evaluation. I think you have to try to ascertain what their motivation is. I think you have to try to ascertain what their level of experience is and what their level of attainment and accomplishment is. And then I think you have to put it all together. I think you have to say, okay, I got to weigh this against that. It's possible.
So where's the line? Okay.
You got to decide where the line is.
Gun running would be a bad
thing. So Dr. Sykes says, where's the line? You know, what if a lama is gun running, as an example? You know, there's one of the stories, I forget exactly who the characters are, but there's a guy who's a hunter, you know, and you know, he goes around shooting sheep. This is in ancient Tibet. And you know, he goes around, he's a herdsman, and you know, he tends sheep, and every now and again he shoots one, you know. And a spiritual practitioner sees him and scorns him and says, don't you know anything? Are you crazy? Don't you know what kind of karma you're creating? Don't you know what you're doing? And you know, another realized being who's there says, you know, you just made a really big mistake. You know, he is a massively realized practitioner. You should be so lucky as to be shot by him, because he guides the consciousness of those beings to the pure realm after he shoots them. So you don't know.
But you can't say that to a person that has the perception of, gee, he's just killed something.
Yeah. So Dr. Sykes' point is, well, you don't know, and you can't just let people go around killing. That's true. That's right.
And it sounds from the average person, they're just trying to legitimize any kind of behavior that they can get away with.
So Dr. Sykes' point is you know, you could go around trying to legitimize any kind of behavior that you think you can get away with, if that's the case. Yeah, people try to do that, actually. It's true. And that's why I'm talking to you. Because, you know, we have to use our faculties of critical evaluation to try to evaluate it. And every person is different, and every person has their own, you know, their own way of looking at it, their own way of evaluating it, you know. And you've got to say, I think this person is incredibly holy, and I think they're pushing my buttons, and I'm willing to have it happen, because I feel strongly that it's for my personal spiritual advancement, and I really think they're doing it with the sweetest of motivations and the purest of heart. And in fact, it's a lama that I know said that he would never enter into a relationship with a student. Well, let me phrase it differently. He said, for a student to enter into tantric relationship with a Vajra master, that student should be willing to die, literally, for that teacher. That is an appropriate relationship between a Vajra disciple and a tantric master. You must be so convinced in your heart of your teacher's motivation that you would be willing to say, you know what? I feel with great certainty that if they killed me, that it would be to guide my consciousness to a pure realm. And I'm okay with that. Now, I don't advocate that, mind you. Please, don't, you know, take it that way. However, there is that element, you know. There is an element where you have to say, okay, I've checked this person out for 10 years, for 20 years, you know. I've spent, you know, a vast amount of time with them, you know. I've watched them practice. I've watched them study. You know, I've watched them behave towards everyone for all this time. And, you know, I got to get off the fence, you know. I got to say, I'm going to take a step back. You get to a point where you yourself feel that you've accumulated enough virtue so that no negative virtue can ripen upon you. Let's put it that way. That's a better way to say it, okay? If you can get to the point where you feel that you have accumulated enough positive virtue and karma so that it's not possible that any kind of major negative thing will happen to you, at that point it's probably appropriate to place yourself fully in the hands of your spiritual teacher. You know, it's really hard to get to that point, and it's a major, major amount of harassment along the way. I can't tell anybody, look, this is the decision, this is the cut, you know, this is the cutoff point. It's true, and this is what we're talking about. Certain people try to use these principles to their gain and to their benefit, you know, and try to push the envelope as much as they can. Certain people try to say, look, I'm self-existently good. Just listen to me, you know. Certain people have ignorant attachment towards a lama, you know. So it's like that. And it's a real problem, you know. And we need to understand just what the lama is. The lama is our projection, you know. And he will change. He must change. He must be in this constant fluctuating state according to the karmas ripening in our mind and our perception. So if you are around a lama and the actual act of perceiving him is consuming your virtuous karma, you've got to generate a massive amount of additional virtuous karma just to continue perceiving a lama, you know, let alone perceiving one who's holier and holier and holier and holier. Okay? So it's like that. Yeah, Vilma. Yeah. She says, let's talk about the qualities of assessing a lama. Here we are. It's time. Yeah, Michael, what were you saying? So, having said all that, how do you check them out? How do you evaluate them? Sal said it's time to quit. Time for a break. Okay, I'll tell you what. let's take a break, do the discussion groups, and when you come back, then we'll go over the, there are 10, I think 10 qualities, there are 10 standard qualities that you use, 10 standard benchmarks that you use to evaluate and assess a lama, okay? We'll talk after. You guys asked, how can you tell if a lama is really qualified or not? How do you know, what do you measure your teacher by? What's the benchmark, what's the standard? What do you check? What characteristics or attributes do you check about your teacher, about the lama? This is also on your homework. So the first is dulwa. Do you say dulwa?
Dulwa.
Dulwa means discipline. It means he or she has discipline. He's controlled. They're controlled. What it means is they possess training on ethical living, on morality. It means that they're keeping their three sets of vows, pratimoksha vows, bodhisattva vows, and secret vows. So this is the first quality which a fully qualified spiritual teacher should have. Second quality is shiwa. You say shiwa?
Shiwa.
Shiwa. It means peace. They're peaceful. What that refers to is that they have an exceptional training in meditation and concentration. They can deeply concentrate. They have peace. Please say Nyershiwa. Nyershiwa means really peaceful. Nyer is really. Means they have, they're completely peaceful. Means they possess a training on wisdom. They deeply understand wisdom, meaning emptiness. They have a deep understanding of emptiness. Yunten? Please say Yunten. Hlakpa. Yunten Hlakpa. Yunten is spiritual qualities. Spiritual qualities. Hlakpa is excessive. It means they have exceeding qualities. It means basically they know a lot more than their students. If you're going to teach someone, you have to know a lot more than they do. So this is what that refers to. You have to have exceeding qualities in the sense that you possess spiritual qualities which are much greater than those of your disciple or your student. Please say Sunche. Sunche means he has effort. Sun is effort. Che is has. He has effort in that he wants to achieve the two goals for both himself and everyone else. It means that that person is primarily spending their time and is dedicating their life towards becoming enlightened themselves and teaching other people to become enlightened with the idea to save them from their suffering. Please say Lungi Chuk. Lungi Chuk means they are rich in scripture. Lung is scripture, Gi is in, Chuk is wealth. Means they've deeply studied the three collections of scripture. They're rich in scripture, the Vinaya, the Sutra, and the Abhidharma. Please say Denyi, Rabtu, Tokpa. Denyi, Rabtu, Tokpa. Denyi is emptiness. Rabtu, Tokpa is great realization. They have a deep realization of suchness, of emptiness. they've had a direct perception of emptiness. Particularly, it means that they can explain the relationship between karma, emptiness, and morality, you know, in a way that's the, kind of the holy grail of Buddhist studies. If you can understand the relationship between karma, emptiness, and your behavior, ethics, then you have the basis to become fully enlightened. You have the kernel and the key to succeed in your practice. You have the meat of it all. Please say Makaden. Makaden. Ma is teach, K is master, Den is possesses. Means he's a master teacher. Means he teaches at precisely the appropriate level for his student, at the appropriate speed for his student. He or she teaches. They teach. You know, they know what you need. They don't teach above you. They don't teach below you. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Not too hot, not too cold. Just right. Please say Tsewe Dakni. Tsewe Dakni. He's the image of love. Tsewe is love. Dakni is the embodiment of. He embodies love. This refers to his motivation. You know, is he teaching because he wants the bucks? Because he wants the fame? Because he wants his face on the cover of a book? Because he wants to have people following him around? Or because he wants to be popular? Or is he teaching because he really cares about the people and loves the people and wants their happiness? And particularly, he's just not pursuing worldly dharmas, worldly motivations. And then finally, the tenth quality is, please say, Kyowa Pang. Kyowa Pang. Kyowa is distaste, and Pang is to give it up. Means he's overcome all distaste for you, his students. What that means is he doesn't get tired of answering your questions 20 times. doesn't mind answering the same question over and over and over again. Okay? Means he's willing to just do it and do it and do it, even though it takes a long time for the student to learn it. They don't quite get it. You know, like that. Doesn't get impatient. He's forgiving when you botch it. That kind of thing. So if you look at this, everybody finished writing the script? Yeah. No? Okay. So if you look at these 10 qualities that we're talking about, you've got someone who is keeping their vows nicely. They meditate nicely. They deeply understand emptiness. They have great spiritual qualities of their own, better than their student. They're making a lot of effort. They're dedicating their life to spiritual activity, particularly to help other people prevent their suffering. They have extensive scriptural knowledge. They've had a direct perception of emptiness. They're a master teacher. They teach exactly to your level. They teach out of love. And they have a lot of patience, and they repeat themselves a lot. So, can you find somebody like that? Where do you find somebody like that? Can you find somebody like that? In the scriptures it says, well, frankly, it's kind of hard to find teachers like that. You know, and if you can't find teachers like that, well, at least try to find someone who's spending most of their time and most of their activity on spiritual things as a bare minimum. Okay? So that's the idea. So this is the authorized scriptural checklist to use in checking out your teacher, your spiritual teacher, and to see if they have all these qualities or a lot of these qualities or enough of these qualities like that. Okay? And in the end, you know, as Dr. Sykes said, you know, how do you know? I mean, what's the cutoff point? what is the point at which you say they went over the line or they went too far, you know, and there's, I just can't be around them anymore. You know, they're not for me. It doesn't work. You know, what is that point? And there is no hard and fast answer. You know, everyone's mind is different. Everyone's capacity is different. And you've all got to decide on your own. But the main point to realize is that a spiritual teacher is a very powerful karmic object because of their potential to do benefit. All right? So whatever your behavior is around a spiritual teacher, you're planting very powerful karmic seeds, for better or for worse. So if you have a really hard time behaving yourself around a spiritual teacher, you know, then personally I would suggest that you distance yourself a little bit so you can, you know, sort of rein it in and get it under control a little bit, because there's no point being around a spiritual teacher if it's only to plant a lot of powerful negative karma, which will ripen upon you quickly. Powerful karmas ripen very quickly. So if you are able to work with your mind to the point where you don't get pissed off excessively at the teacher, or you know, where you can do virtue in relationship to the teacher, then, you know, great, be around them. But be very careful, you know, it's a very slippery slope, it's very tricky. Something like that. And I hope everyone here can, you know, have the perception of having pure teachers, pure holy teachers. And to do that, you know, you have to start treating people as if they are your teacher. It's one of the advices of the Bodhisattva vows, actually, one of the actual Bodhisattva vows is to see all beings as your teacher. You know, if you don't do that, you're not keeping your Bodhisattva vows. Is to train yourself to think that everyone that you meet all day long is trying to teach you a lesson for your benefit, and that every single person you encounter is some kind of teacher for you, and that they are knowingly, intentionally, and consciously engaging with you in the way that they are to teach you something, you know. So, you know, how do you start to accumulate the karma to have spiritual teachers? Keep that Bodhisattva vow, you know, and you know, plant the karmas to create very holy beings for yourself. So I get very frustrated myself sometimes because it's like, man, I really hate this. You know, this is such a pain in the ass. I really wish you weren't like this. You know, I really wish this person wasn't like that. You know, I wish I should go find somebody better, you know. However, in the end, if I ask myself, you know, what do all my other projections look like, you know? Am I projecting anything any better anywhere else, you know? Well, fortunately not. Yeah, go ahead. So the question is, what about your loyalty? This has to be the last question because we have to go. So the question is, what about your loyalty towards your lama? You know, if you have a lama, a teacher, and other teachers come into town or are around, is it okay to go to their teachings? Are you betraying your lama in some way? Something like that, you know? No, not at all. You know, if they are a if they are a pure teacher, they want you to learn, you know. They want you to advance yourself. And, you know, any way that you can do that, you know, great, all the better. So, you know, perhaps they know enough that they can see your mind, see the stream of your karma, see exactly what's right for your mind. And they know that you'll get the most benefit if you study with them that day on that subject as opposed to someone else. But if you don't have that kind of intimate relationship with a teacher, you know, where they are personally saying, this is, you know, this is the best thing for you right now, it's, you know, you advance yourself in any way you can, is my opinion. You know, study wherever you can and anywhere you can. You know, that's why the Buddha taught so many different techniques in so many different ways and so many different levels, because every being's mind is different, you know, and they need different teachings and different presentations on different levels and in different ways. So, yeah, study away. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to accumulate virtue. So, See, now, I'm glad you rejoice. Now I get to rejoice in your rejoicing. We're all just like snowballing merit here, you know? This is great.